Good morning, everybody. I'm Larry Jacobs.
Excuse me.
Jeez, where'd that come from? Hi, everybody. I'm Larry Jacobs. Let's start that over again. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Hold on a second. I'm going to put my mic on mute. Hold on. Oh, my God. Hell of a way to start a show. Wasn't that? For goodness sakes, I apologize. All of a sudden, I had a cough. So forgive me, okay? This is Larry Jacobs, Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, and thank you so much for listening today. I got my old friend Star Saxstein here, the incredible Ms. Saxstein at Ms. at Saxstein, S-A-C-K-S-T-E-I-N, .com. She is just an amazing person, educator, author, speaker, all those things. She's going to talk about her new book, which is called Assessing with Respect, Everyday Practices that meet students' social and emotional needs. It's all about assessment. We're going to talk about this in great detail with my pal Star. And we're part of the American Consortium for Equity in Education over at ace-ed.org. That's where we park all of our podcasts. Our magazine is over there, the great online journal, Equity and Access. Hope you enjoy that when you go over there and flip through. It's, again, online at ace-ed.org. So I got very clocky here, all right? This is really weird, all right? And we want you to join with us about equity. We really work hard to bring the industry and you guys, all the educators of the world, together to make sure that we're all moving forward together in step for equity. So please, it's over at ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org. Enjoy the magazine, the podcast, and everything else we do over there. All right, let me bring on Star. Hi, Star. Sorry I was coughing. I can apologize to you on behalf of the whole.
Oh, it's all good. I hope you're feeling all right.
It was just weird. All of a sudden, the show started. All of a sudden, I just had to cough. Okay, it was like a morning cold thing or whatever, morning bubbles, whatever. So I apologize for that. I'm fine. Thank you for asking. On that note, how are you, my dear?
I am very good, thank you. I'm excited to be here and talk about the new book. It actually fits a lot with what you were just talking about with equity.
I know it does. And you've been on top of this stuff for years about equity and access and everything else and doing the right thing for kids and really recognizing what kids are all about and what teachers need to do to make the right things happen. You are superstars, no pun intended, Ms. Saxstein.
Thank you. I don't think I'm a superstar, but
you are.
Certainly do what I can.
Yeah, you do more than most people, I got to tell you. So I really think you are. Yeah, your parents named you right, Star. You are a star. Is that the reason for this? Because you were born to be a star?
I don't know about that. I think my parents were just hippie throwbacks, liked the name. I was also, from my Jewish background, the star, the S in my name came from my great-grandmother. So just lucky, I guess.
Yeah, it's a great name, okay? And the L in my name came from my grandfather. There you go. He was a Louis. I'm a Larry. There you go. Okay? We're even.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good enough. Talk about your book, Assessing Kids. Assessing with Respect. Talk about student assessment, okay? Talk about this.
This book is, I think, an evolution of my thinking over the last, 10 to 12 years with this assessment work that I've been working on and really trying to articulate a lot of the things that were implicit in what I was doing but wasn't explicitly said. So with the pandemic as it has been, and I wrote the book during the pandemic, so it did shift the focus quite a lot because I felt like it would have been tone deaf had I ignored a lot of the equity challenges that we've had issues in equity since the beginning in terms of our educational system, but I think over the last year and a half, it's been pretty hard to ignore the challenges
Been exposed. The shell, the cover has been thrown off. Okay, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. It's unbelievable. I always describe it this way, Star. We kicked the can down the road long enough, and eventually we got to the end of the road, and it was a cliff, and we all fell off last March 13th, okay, a year ago.
Yeah.
All right, and suddenly on the way down, it all became exposed. And FYI, we all knew this, okay, But it was just kind of, well, let's put it off. We're thinking about it. Yeah, we could maybe do something. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. But the time has come. That's why I love the way you think. Okay, you see that and you start to do something about it.
Right. So essentially what became really important in this text was making my readers aware of some very important resources, because I wouldn't call myself an equity expert, but I do think the practices I've employed for the last, 15 years have been all about getting student voice and choice, all student voice and choice, and then adjusting my assessment style to not label children. And what really makes this book different is that it addresses the emotional toll that grading systems and traditional assessments place on children. And it speaks to how educators can practically consider their choices in terms of assessment, starting with building really good relationships so that the assessments that are designed can best meet the strengths of children, working from a strengths model rather than a deficit one.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also speaks to reflection and self-assessment, and also teaching kids how to be mindful of their own learning, to advocate for themselves, and how these practices help them to have the tools to do it, which is really important. We need to be listening to our kids and not punishing them, labeling them, penalizing them for things that are basically compliance-based, and our systems have to be less about compliance and more about learning.
Right. You know, it's so true. One of the things your books talks about, okay, is it's the impact of a grade on a student's self-image, okay? And to me, and a lot of us don't really understand that. We kind of know what a grade means, okay? And we assess both with the standardized test and testing, and also you're throwing a little anecdotal stuff in there from what we would go with the kid. But that grade creates an image within the kid's mind, and if you start to repeat that enough, that image starts to stay, okay? And if we don't take that student self-image, and I'll call it under that umbrella of social-emotional learning, okay, we create a lot of challenges and a lot of problems, all right? And we don't do it intentionally, but we do it. Talk about that, about students. What you learned as you were writing this about student self-image, okay, and grading, the way we assess.
So anytime we label kids, we have this underlying power to subvert the way that they feel about themselves. And like you suggested, Larry, it has nothing to do with our intention to make them feel badly about themselves, but many kids internalize that message. So if they persistently do poorly in a math class, for example, they start to say, I'm not really good at math, I'm not a math student. And then their entire emotion around even attending math classes or new math classes, they already come into that situation with a negative feeling that they aren't capable. And really what I'm advocating for is for us to sort of stop labeling kids and mm-hmm. allowing us to have this growth mindset that teaches kids we all start in one place and we all have somewhere to move, and we don't need to label that on like a spectrum of good to bad.
Yeah.
It's just a spectrum of, this is where you are in terms of your skill set toward mastery, and we can all get there when we're given the right tools. And, I did speak to a lot of students about, their feelings about grades and what the impact of those labels have done to them.
What'd you hear? What was the feedback on that?
Well, kids have a lot of anxiety these days. I think that when we were growing, when I was growing up, when you were growing up, I think that there was anxiety, but not to the level of what kids experience today. I think the internet and all these other things that sort of make everything visible, there's no anonymity in not doing well at this point. And then kids kind of, again, internalize it. So the bad labels they place on themselves. And you know what? The good labels, too, because think about those traditionally higher-achieving students who will say, I'm an A student. And when they say I'm an A student and then they encounter a class that might be more challenging or isn't within their natural aptitude and they struggle, the amount of perfectionism and pressure they put on themselves try to achieve, it just doesn't do good things. Like, it manifests in our health in a lot of different ways. And we see kids, you know, obviously with all kinds of different challenges now that, you know, I don't think were as evident 20 years ago, 30 years ago, as they are right now. I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Finish up.
I was just going to say,
you know what's interesting about this, okay? Well, a lot of things are interesting about it. Again, everybody, the book is assessing with respect, Star Saxstein, okay? But knowing all that and everybody listening, every single teacher would agree with you, okay? How do we find out? Okay, how a kid is reacting to grades and how and grades prior to you, even the generic you, okay, and how do we work with this? How do we make sure that we assess each kid with the respect they need? And so we're talking about a lot of kids for every different teacher. How do we do that? How do we really find that respect?
Well, we start by listening. And we stop with our own personal agendas. Like, I understand that there's curriculum that needs to be taught, and I also understand that there's pressure on teachers to make sure that they get through it so students are successful on state exams, which, I mean, that's another whole topic for another show about why we do
that.
But really, if kids aren't getting it, I can't see moving through curriculum just to move through it. So we start by building these relationships with kids where they feel safe to tell us that they're struggling. We use and embed the language of learning in class so that they know how to articulate what they know and can do. We give them opportunities to reflect on learning experiences so that we can adjust our instructional practices based on what we learn. We ensure that kids have multiple opportunities to show what they know in a variety of different ways.
Very good.
So that, you know, they have that opportunity to do things in a way that they feel confident doing it while we're teaching them and giving them more practice in the areas that they're struggling in. And I think when we create cultures like that in our classroom where the expectation is it's normal not to get it on your first try, and the structure is set up so that everybody has multiple tries. And if you get it on your second, but your classmate gets it on their fifth, it doesn't matter just as long as everybody gets it.
Gets it.
Like, that's what matters most. Yep.
When you look at – when you think back to your teaching career, or I think back to mine or anybody listening, okay, is thinking back on theirs or in theirs right now, okay, because you're out of the classroom right now, okay, Star. Okay, so my question is, how many people look back and just from what you know, how many people actually think they, how many people that you know of, what do you think the percentage is of teachers who are doing it right? Really look.
It's hard to say. I mean, I think because of who I surround myself with, the folks that I generally hang with are folks who are doing great work and are pushing things forward. But as an instructional coach, as somebody who works with teacher teams, you know, everybody's at a different level of readiness. I think the pandemic, like we started with, really opened up some folks to acknowledge that we have to do things differently. My greatest hope is that once things go back to, and I'm air quotes here, normal, whatever
normal,
that's going to look like, you know, I'm hoping that we don't slide back into the way we were doing things before and that some of the great changes that have occurred over the last year aren't just, you know, Band-Aids for dealing with the pandemic, but rather an opportunity for us to explore how we could continue to build on some of these practices to ensure that our most marginalized students are getting what they need to be successful. And it's a really tough thing to be able to acknowledge that when you've been doing something for a long time, that it's not what's best for kids, because I really do believe that 98% of educators go into education because they want to do right by kids.
Of course.
And we have to always assume that positive intent. But I think a lot of well-vetted structures that are in place do more harm than they do good. And we all have to be examining that all the time, you know, starting with our own implicit biases, thinking about things we bring to the table. Yep. We have to be doing that work ourselves all the time. Like, that's something that we project and we might not even be conscious of. And, you know, we have to go out of our way to start doing that deep work so that we understand ourselves, so that we're not unconsciously kind of treating different kids differently because of that.
It's so true. Star, think back to when you were in the college for teacher education. I do this quite a bit. I was in it long before you were, okay? But did anybody ever teach you how to assess kids in education school?
Sadly, no.
I never had anything in it. I mean, it was just, you know, I guess I just went into my first job and ABCDE was what they told me, and it was just whatever the kids got on tests, which I was making up myself as a 22-year-old, 23-year-old, I guess. Okay, and this is the way I was assessing kids, okay, something I'm an expert in assessing kids. It was never mentioned when I was in education school. It was never mentioned when you were in education school. Are they mentioning it today? Do you know?
I think they are. I do speak with a lot of pre-service teachers, and I also speak with a lot of graduate, like leadership programs.
Sure.
And I've certainly been lobbying to maybe get a course in one of the local schools that I work that live around me on Long Island to possibly offer a graduate course in alternative assessment and just philosophies of assessment and, you know, the impacts of those things. Because I really do think that both educators and leaders need to be well-versed in just the variety of what's out there. I think a lot of the time people just don't know that there are other ways to do things.
Right.
For whatever reasons. And sometimes they just need to be exposed to alternative forms of assessment and, you know, thinking about different kinds of learners and how those different kinds of assessments would speak to the strengths of those students.
And you know, your point is well taken. It has to speak to the strength of students. It not only has to speak to what they've learned, but also their social and emotional needs. It's a combination of the two things that you have to be very, very aware of. Okay, and I don't think a lot of teachers are. That over the course of time, maybe they become that way. But there's no reason why we can't really delve into this in these early years and make sure that all teachers from the very beginning understand the value of, I like your term, philosophy of assessment. Okay, it's just like, man, we really have to look at this and dig deep on this. And when you said, you know, implicit biases, and by the way, I want to say we all tend to grade the way we were graded. Okay, everybody went to school.
That's where we start.
Yeah, everybody went to school. Everybody knows how their teacher's graded. Okay, so that's the way we grade. Okay, it's just a habit, which really isn't that good, because some of those teachers, like me and you, were taught a long time ago. And we've learned a lot more since then. There's a lot more involved in grading. Okay, and one of those things is to understand. Okay, and this last year certainly brought this up. Okay, the implicit biases that we have, which we all have, it's nothing to be ashamed or embarrassed about. I don't care what color you are, how old you are, whatever. Everybody has implicit biases, and we can't let that feed in. Talk about implicit biases. Go for it.
So,
Ms. Taxman,
when I was in my leadership program, one of the courses that I took, we had to go to Harvard. Harvard has a website that has a bunch of different tests that check, you know, what your implicit biases are. And there are like 20 plus tests that you could take where they show you different images and you have to react. You don't think about which one you're picking. You react to whatever question is there. And then at the end, it'll tell you where you are on the spectrum, you know, of for that particular item. Like I did one on gender, I did one on race, I did one on age. And I was actually shocked by what I learned, particularly around the gender one, because I consider myself, I wouldn't go as far as to say a feminist, but I definitely say that I'm somebody who advocates for women in every role, because we are a capable group of human beings. And, you know, it's certainly something I feel very passionately about. And I was shocked to see just how much of a bias existed there, even with that issue. I was actually a lot more in the middle on some of the racial stuff, because it's work I've been doing for a really long time. And because most of the schools I've taught in have been high poverty, high diversity environments. And when you get to know a lot of folks who are different than you are, your perspective on those things, it's all about knowing and understanding perspectives of all the people that you're dealing with, and growing to understand their perspective. There are certain things that I will never experience personally because I am a white female and I come from affluence, and there are a lot of things that my perspective is in some ways really, you know, kind of stunted by, because I don't have that other context that a lot of other people do. I try very hard to empathize with as many people that I can, but I want to acknowledge the fact that there are certain experiences I will never be able to personally understand, but I could try hard to really take in what I learned from other people and continue to have those dialogues. And that's part of what's in here as well. The whole last chapter is about personalized learning. There's a lot about equity in it, and just understanding that even when we expect kids to, for example, write all the time, like that's not always, that writing is not the only way to assess student learning. We could have kids record themselves. We could have kids on video. Right. We could have them draw pictures. We could have them do a million different things that could still show what they know and can also honor their cultural backgrounds as well.
Yeah, and we have to be careful. You know, people might think that a bias test would show that you don't like a certain group. But you have to also be careful if you're very concerned about an ethnic group and you go out of your way to make sure they do better. That's not fair either, okay, because you want to make sure you assess the child properly, okay, and give them a fair assessment, not based on either a good or bad bias on your part. It's really a difficult thing, and it's something everybody goes to school. We're responsible for kids being successful in their life. Think about that. Okay, and so we really have to look at this and make sure that we put kids on the right path and assess them fairly and with great respect, which, by the way, is what your book is about. It's unbelievable. Want to talk more about the equity thing?
Sure. I mean, it's really about creating opportunities to treat all people with dignity. I had introduced to you a while ago Dr. Floyd Cobb, who came on to the show to talk about his book, Belonging to a Culture of Dignity, with John Crownapple. The two of them wrote that book. And they, you know, there's a little bit of their belonging information that's featured in this book as well, because it really does speak to a piece of equity that I don't think is really touched upon. I think a lot of time we talk about inclusion, but we don't talk about belonging. Creating environments where people really feel like they belong there. And there's tons of research, they speak to it in their book quite a lot, about the impact of that feeling of belonging. And when we create our educational environments, it's so important that kids feel like they have a place inside of that space so that they can thrive and make mistakes and grow from those mistakes and continue to push forward with whatever their unique perspective is.
Yeah, it's so darn important. You know, your book is subtitled Everyday Practices That Meet Students' Social and Emotional Needs. All right? And SEL, social emotional learning, has become a real touchstone in most school districts, if not all of them, for this coming year. They are very, very concerned about the impact of the pandemic. Again, that's, I hate to say this, we should always be concerned about SEL, but this, the horror of the pandemic came and brought it bubbling up to the top of the volcano, okay? And everybody's concerned about that, all right? So what's a kid to do? As we teach kids to understand their own socialization and emotional needs, okay, what's the role, what should a teacher tell a student that the student's role is when I'm teaching you? How do you approach me, okay, and talk to me about what you need in terms of me assessing you with respect, if I may use your title.
First we need to give, like, teach the language of learning to kids so that they have that vocabulary to be able to express their needs. And I think we often assume that kids know how to share their concerns or share about their learning, and they really don't, unless we've made an intentional, if we've made an intentional point to help kids understand what they are learning, why they are learning it, and how it applies to the rest of their lives, so mm-hmm. that they even know when and where to speak out. That's why I've always kind of used reflection. It's a great place to start to build that relationship when students are setting their own academic goals, and then they're reflecting on the learning that they've done through various projects that we do in class, and they're sharing, you know, whether or not they met the goals that they set for themselves and how they know. It's an opportunity for them to say, you know, I know how to do this, and you could see that in this part of my work, but I'm still struggling with this, and I need help because the strategies that we've been using in class haven't been working. So even just giving them multiple opportunities, not just, you know, saying to a whole class, does anybody need help? Because a lot of times, especially in high school, you're not going to get a kid who's going to be comfortable saying in front of a whole class that I'm struggling. So there needs to be multiple opportunities for them to first identify that they're struggling and then speak up for themselves. And that can't be something that comes with any kind of retribution. It's got to be something that's met with the utmost, you know, support.
Right, and you've got to give them the opportunity to do that, okay, without making them feel self-aware, so to speak, so that they feel comfortable. The whole thing, as you said it before, it has to do with belonging, has to do with a comfort level, and it has to do with respect. And this is key stuff, and I only hope every teacher's college in the world reads your book, Star, okay, and starts really teaching people how to do this. Yeah, I mean, it's what you've hit on is so important, and it's something that teachers kind of take for granted. We have to really delve into assessment because we are really making an impact on kids' lives. And if we don't understand the importance of that impact, there's going to be some real trouble for these kids. So I think it's just so important. I mean, it's just what you've done, as always, is just so important and so timely, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you, Star. This was great. I love it.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Larry. I appreciate it.
Well, I love having you on. You know, I'll say it again. You know, you really are a superstar in all this. You stand out, okay? And you really get the job done. I'm so proud to know you. You're just a wonderful person. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Hope everybody has a great day.
Yeah, and you take care of yourself, and we'll talk again soon, okay? Enjoy life on Long Island. One word, okay?
Sounds great. Have a good one.
Thanks, Star. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Star Saxteen, everybody, at Ms. Saxteen, MsSaxteen.com. And the new book is Assessing with Respect. And it takes into consideration social-emotional needs of the students and how we approach learning. It's just, this is grading. It's so important, okay, because that grading has such an impact on kids. Okay, so please, it's an ASCD book, so please check it out, okay? But you can look on MsSaxteen.com. Okay, we're going to archive over at ace-ed.org, over at our Consortium for Equity. Join with us over there, okay? We really want your voice heard. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. I think my voice sounds tinny today. I don't know. Anyway, thanks for listening.